global power. But you also talk about ultimately what it will take to overthrow it. What are your thoughts on this, as the former Greek finance minister, Yanis?
Well, imagine a world in which you have the right to your own data, which cannot be harvested by anyone. And if anybody harvests it, you can actually sue them for billions. Then everything would change very, very quickly. Imagine if you, Amy, or I, you know, I want to leave Twitter, especially after Elon Musk took it. But if I go to Blue Sky or somewhere else, I lose a million followers. Imagine that you could carry your followers along with you through a piece of legislation that allows for, or allows, imposes interoperability. And if you want us to go a bit more radically to the left, imagine a world in which every corporation is owned by the people who work in them, that, you know, shares become like library cards in universities and colleges, where you simply get it while you're there and you lose it when you're not there. Suddenly, you have a very different world. And if you add to that a digital wallet provided by the Fed to every American resident, suddenly, why would you want to have an account with Bank of America or with Citigroup, who now own your money? They own the payment system. So these are some ideas that progressives can fight around the world. If we want to free ourselves from the clutches of the techno-feudal lords, which today not only force us to do things on their behalf, but actually very much train us to input desires into our heads.
Yanis Varoufakis, want to thank you for being with us, former finance minister of Greece. His most recent book is Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism. German police just broke up a conference that was co-sponsored by his organization, DiEM25, dealing with Palestinian rights. Next up, we speak with Palestinian journalist Dalia Hatouka, who says Western media coverage of Israel's war on Gaza has helped Israel avoid growing calls for ceasefire. We'll also speak with journalist Peter Maas about his new piece for The Washington Post, I'm Jewish and I've covered wars. I know war crimes when I see them. Back in 30 seconds. Where Are the Millions? By Julia Boutros. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Intercept is reporting. The New York Times has instructed its reporters to avoid using the terms genocide, ethnic cleansing, and occupied territory in its coverage of Israel's war on Gaza. The Intercept's report is based on an internal memo from the Times. One newsroom source told the Intercept, quote, I think it's the kind of thing that looks professional and logical if you have no knowledge of the historical context of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. But if you do know, it'll be clear how apologetic it is to Israel, they said. Today, we're joined by a Palestinian journalist who's been highly critical of how the Western media has portrayed Israel's war in Gaza. Dalia Hatouka is an independent Palestinian journalist specializing in Israeli-Palestinian affairs, usually based between Amman, Jordan, and Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. She was a close friend and colleague of the Al Jazeera reporter Shireen Abu Akleh, who was shot dead by an Israeli sniper in the occupied West Bank May 11th, 2022. Dalia's latest piece for the Century Foundation is headlined Undercover of Gaza War, Assault on West Bank Accelerates. Dalia joins us now in our New York studio after speaking last night at the Columbia Journalism School. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. This was also the topic of your panel at the Columbia J School last night, the issue of how the conflict is being covered. What do you think is most important for people to understand, Dahlia?
Well, I think that a lot of what's missing from the bigger portrait or the puzzle, so to speak, is the Palestinian voice. So in order to find out what's going on in Gaza, we need to not just rely on Western journalists coming into Gaza. I know that's very important, and it's a demand by a lot of us and by, you know, the Committee to Protect Journalists and other journalism rights groups. But it's also to amplify Palestinian voices, because ultimately nobody knows Gaza better than the Gazan journalists on the ground who are actually doing the work that they're doing right now. And in a way, these journalists, not only are they fighting for their lives while doing all of this, they're also resorting to extraordinary measures to be able to cover what's going on. And speaking to journalists on the ground, they tell us that what we're seeing from them is only like 10% of what's happening in Gaza at the moment.
Now, Dahlia, I wanted to ask you, the Western press does have the opportunity to cover what is going on in the West Bank. And yet this, as you wrote in a recent piece, more than 4,000 West Bank Palestinians have been displaced just in 2023, the highest number ever recorded. What is going on in the West Bank from what you've been able to see?
Basically, in the West Bank, the fog of war has allowed Israel to perpetuate crimes at a very large scale, not only throughout the West Bank, but including occupied East Jerusalem. And in the West Bank, we've got what a lot of even Israeli officials have admitted are pogroms that are going on by and being perpetrated by Israeli settlers, especially in villages around Nablus, for example, which are in the north, where there are many settlements surrounding villages. We're not talking about just, you know, the torching of houses and the torching of cars and whatnot. We're talking about people getting killed by armed settlers. And while they're being armed and attacking Palestinians, they're also being helped or aided by Israeli soldiers whose job technically is to be there to not allow such things to happen. But in a way, you know, sometimes they just sit by idly and not do anything, or they actually participate in these attacks. That's why when you look at the UN figures, a lot of the times we see, you know, 10 Palestinians have been killed by settlers, 2 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces. But then there is a line that says 3 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli settlers and or soldiers. So we don't know, because they are part of the system that's subjugating these Palestinians, that's, you know, carrying out all this violence against them.
And it's not just those who are killed, but also the detentions of Palestinians in the West Bank. Could you talk about the conditions that they're facing in Israeli custody?
The detentions, honestly, they're atrocious, and they are the least talked about, even among Western journalists who actually haven't been really mentioning this at all. We're talking about the least amount of you know, livable situations that can be, that any detainee can live in. So they get water up to 2 hours a day now. Sometimes they don't get to shower. The food that they get is rotten. I'm talking about the detainees in the 9,000 or so in Israeli prisons. They don't have access to their families. They don't have access to lawyers. The people who have come out with some have had their limbs amputated because of the extended use handcuffs. So honestly, the conditions are really harrowing, and there's not much access. And right now, as we speak, I was just seeing that there is a detainee who died in an Israeli hospital a few days ago. And his body is still being withheld, and his family has not been able to put him to rest, because even though he had already carried out his sentence, 30 or more years, which is quite frankly a devastating thing for the family, because they're unable to get any kind of closure.
You're talking, of course, about Waleed Daqqa. His human rights groups, everyone had asked for him to be released, as he was there for almost 40 years and he was dying of cancer. Speaking of people who have died not in prison but outside, the last time I spoke to you was just after Shireen Abu Akleh was killed, May 11, 2022, as she was a dear friend of yours, the Al Jazeera Arabic reporter outside the Jenin refugee camp, all laid out now, determined to be an Israeli sniper who killed her. As her colleagues tried to reach her, they shot at them, clearly wearing press. It wasn't in the middle of any kind of skirmish. They were just standing outside. This issue of journalists being killed that you spoke of before, the memorial for Shireen outside Jenin has now been bulldozed over, destroyed by the Israeli military. But even in Gaza, and you took this up last night, you and your colleagues on the panel, of what's happening to journalists. Even you were surprised, you said, as we spoke before the show, by learning about when David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, asked, how do you know that journalists are targeted? Talk about the response.
Basically, we were very lucky to have a journalist from Gaza who managed to leave the coastal enclave, the besieged coastal enclave, to Qatar. Her name is Amira Harouda. And she had to leave, obviously, because, you know, for her well-being and her family, she has four kids. Anyways, she was talking about the fact that journalists would get phone calls from Israeli authorities, military authorities, basically questioning them about their work, especially if they worked for Qatar, which is a little strange considering that Qatar is the go-between, between Israel and Hamas for the talks to reach a ceasefire and to release the hostages. So, in the meantime, also CPJ, was talking to a few journalists who were released after being detained, and they had been taken away for 33 days, made to sit in squatting positions in horrific conditions. They came out, having lost 30 kilos or so. There's a lot going on in that sense, but also the targeting of journalists. People know because there are UAVs or drones, as we say, constantly hovering in Gaza. It's so perpetual that people in Gaza, if they don't hear a UAV, they think something's wrong. UAVs have been part of the Gaza skyline for years, long before October 7th.
And even the phone calls from the Israeli military to journalists threatening them?
Yes, absolutely. And in the West Bank, they do the same thing. They call them in, they say, we want to have a chat with you, and then they don't come out because, they take them in, they can put them in administrative detention, which, as you know, is basically when you put people in or Palestinians in prison without any kind of proof or without charging them, and it's very easy to do that. I mean, right now there's a young Christian girl who's a student. She's in administrative detention for 4 months, and I know that the Archbishop of Canterbury was calling for her release. So all these things are intertwined. There's a lot of things going on that are far-reaching. It's not just about journalists.
And the journalists who are being detained in Gaza are being questioned about their reporting?
Absolutely.
Interrogated for hours?
Absolutely, because what The questions that they were being asked is, why did you write this? Why did you say this? Do you talk to Hamas people? Of course they talk to Hamas people. It's their job. It's like how you talk to Israeli forces. You're going to how you talk to Israeli military personnel or government officials. I mean, that's your job as a journalist. Your job is to talk to people.
And I wanted to ask you, Dalia Hatouka, you're usually based in Amman, Jordan, or in Ramallah in the West Bank, but you're here in the United States now. What's your message to the American public and to the Biden administration, given that this country is the largest supplier of weapons and military aid to Israel?
I think, honestly, the American public has been very instrumental in working with Palestinians. A large segments of the American public have been working with Palestinians. I've seen a lot of support. I've seen a lot of support among Israelis. The few Israelis who get it. I've seen a lot of support among American Jews, and I believe that they are one of the Palestinians' biggest allies. But my message, obviously, to Biden is, there's a lot at stake right now. The Biden administration can do so much, and that's been proven over by the fact that, once Biden put his foot down, several steps were taken by Israel in order to open the border crossings or some of the border crossings into Gaza. But I believe that taking this kind of blind support for Netanyahu is leading us nowhere. And as an American as well, not only as a Palestinian, I have bigger fears of what's to come November, because if Biden loses the election, and he might because of the situation, because of what's going on in Gaza, then we are doomed basically to have another 4 years of a Trump administration. So in my mind, I'm like, we are doomed in the Middle East. We're doomed in the U.S., and I know that's a lot of doom and gloom, but honestly, these are some of the thoughts that people, especially dual nationals like me, these are some of the thoughts that they have.
Dalia Hatouka, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian independent journalist, usually based between Amman, Jordan, and occupied Ramallah. That's Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Next up, we speak with journalist Peter Maas. He has a new piece for The Washington Post. It's headlined, "I'm Jewish and I've Covered Wars. I Know War Crimes When I See Them." Stay with us.
سقطت ولن تسقط لا ولن نسقط ما دمنا باقون صبا كنهر الغيب يا غزة انا بروحي معاك ولو بلاك الدنيا جنة من وجع بحرك يا روح الروم وجعنا احنا نسقط ان سقطت ولن تسقط لا ولن نسقط ما دمنا باقون صبا كنهر الغيب مفشع لدموع لما العاجز يكون نصيب وسكوت يحتل كل حواسك وهموم مستني الدفا لكن هاي نار بتحرق البيوت
If only once by Big Sam. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with journalist Peter Maas, who has written an opinion piece for The Washington Post headlined, "I'm Jewish and I've Covered Wars. I Know War Crimes When I See Them," unquote. Until recently, Peter was a senior editor at The Intercept. He's the author of Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War. He covered the Bosnia War for The Washington Post and the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq for The New York Times Magazine. Peter, welcome to Democracy Now! You begin your piece in The Washington Post by saying, "How does it feel to be a war crimes reporter whose family bankrolled a nation that's committing war crimes? I can tell you." Lay it out for us.
Well, my great-great-grandfather was Jacob Schiff, who was a financier at the end of the 19th century and early 20th century, one of the wealthiest people in the country, probably, who donated a lot of money and organized the movement of Jews, persecuted Jews from Europe, largely from Russia, but also from other countries in Russia, to any safe haven that would have them, including America, but also significantly British-controlled Palestine. And then his son-in-law, my great-grandfather, Felix Warburg, who married Jacob Schiff's daughter, continued that process of supporting and helping to organize the migration of persecuted Jews from Europe to British-controlled Palestine. This is before World War II, the Holocaust, and the establishment of Israel.
Yet you say they were anti-Zionists. Can you explain?
Well, they were non-Zionists, which was actually different, significantly different from being anti-Zionist. There was a movement amongst American Jews and Jews elsewhere in Europe that was called non-Zionism. And for them, the non-Zionists, the point was Jews should be able to go to British-controlled Palestine. They need to go to British-controlled Palestine because they need refuge from the persecution they're suffering in Europe. But they were against the establishment of a Jewish state for two reasons. One is that they were concerned that if there were a Jewish state, then all the anti-Semites in America and elsewhere would look at Jews who are not living in this Jewish state and say, your loyalty is actually this other country. And that would kind of increase suspicions of Jews and make them seem lesser citizens in the countries that they were living in. And then the second concern, which is one that a lot of people had, but that non-Zionists also had and pronounced, was they were concerned about violence between Arabs and Jews. They just kind of said, look, you know, if one side, the Jews or the Arabs for that matter, try to exert total control over the state that's going to be established there, because remember, at this time, Palestine was under the control of British mandate, then it's going to be really violent. My great-grandfather referred to it as a shooting gallery.
And Peter, you also covered the wars in Croatia and Bosnia. And could you talk about how your journalism there helps inform your perspective of what's going on? Because many of course, our listeners and viewers are not familiar with those wars and the war crimes committed there.
In the early 1990s, Yugoslavia, which was a kind of conglomeration of different republics, five or six, I forget the precise number, actually, began to fall apart. And instead of falling apart peacefully, it fell apart violently. And there was first a war when Slovenia, one of the republics, seceded. And then there was an even larger war when Croatia, another one of its constituent republics, seceded. And then when Bosnia did the same, this was in 1992, this was unfortunately the largest war of all. There were a significant number of Serbs who lived in Bosnia. And Slobodan Milosevic, who was the leader in Belgrade of kind of all Serbs in the country, organized the kind of provisioning of military material and soldiers, guerrilla fighters, paramilitaries, to go in and basically fight against the Muslims and Croats in Bosnia who wanted to have an independent state and who voted in a referendum for an independent state. And the warfare, which I went to cover, it was not your ordinary war of army against army. It was a war of paramilitaries committing atrocities against defenseless civilians, largely Muslims, some Croats. And it also consisted of sieges against the few cities that were able to resist the onslaught. Sarajevo was one of these cities. Srebrenica was another one of these cities. And so I was there covering this war, seeing terrible things happen that are not supposed to happen in war. I mean, wars are violent. Civilians get killed in wars, but it's not always illegal. In this case, there were civilians right under my window in Sarajevo getting shot by snipers. I wrote about that. There were civilians whose houses were getting bombed. There were civilians who were standing in bread lines who were getting bombed and killed. There were aid shipments of medicine and food that were being prohibited from entry into these so-called safe areas because they were supposed to have been protected by the United Nations, but were not. And so I was there reporting on this. And in 1993, a year after this war began, there was an international criminal tribunal that was set up to investigate war crimes and possible genocide that was occurring at the time in Bosnia. And that tribunal subsequently did hold a number of trials, including a senior Bosnian Serb leaders, the military leader Ratko Mladic, the political leader Radovan Karadzic, and the Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic, in which the charges included genocide. And both Karadzic and Mladic are now in jail for the rest of their lives on charges that include genocide. So I was reporting on this genocide.
As you compare what you saw in Bosnia to what you saw in Gaza, you write in that piece, "When I reported from besieged Sarajevo, I stayed in a hotel that was smack on the front line with Serbian snipers routinely firing at civilians walking under my window. On a spring day in 1993, I heard the familiar crack and whistle of a sniper's bullet, followed by an awful scream. I went to my window and saw a wounded civilian trying to crawl to safety." Writing in the Post more than three decades ago, "I described the man's desperate shouts as a mad howl of a person pushed over the edge. It came from the lungs, from the heart, from the mind," you write in the Washington Post. You also write about disturbing video footage from Gaza that shows Khalek Reis walking on a so-called safe route in January with her grandson, five-year-old Taim Adel, who was holding a white flag when she was shot and killed by an Israeli sniper. Talk about the comparisons, or what you call the rhymes.
Yeah, I mean, God, I remember those stories so well. This is the most, there's so many disturbing things going on in Gaza now and in the West Bank. But as the Israeli attack began after the Hamas attack on October 7th against Israel, you know, we began seeing these videos and reports emerging from these very brave journalists in Gaza of what was happening. And, for example, that video of this grandmother being shot, obviously quite intentionally. And everything that I was seeing, flower line massacres in Gaza, for example, airdrops of humanitarian aid that killed some of the people they were intended to help because they landed on top of these people, also happened in Bosnia. I began seeing just the same kinds of incidents that were the constituent elements in Bosnia of genocide also happening in Gaza, but kind of most disturbing in a way, at a scale that was larger than Bosnia. I mean, for example, you know, in Bosnia, over the course of its four-year war, there were something like 7,000 or 8,000 children killed, which is terrible. In Gaza, over the course of just 6 months, there have been more than 13,000 children killed. So, you know, I just could not help but see not only the parallels, but also how what seems to be unfolding in Gaza is even worse than what I saw in Bosnia.
And we have less than a minute left, but I'm wondering your perspective on how the U.S. media has been covering the war in Gaza.
It's been a real mixed bag, and it was a real mixed bag in Bosnia. You know, and we're all kind of captives of our experiences, and so I covered the war in Bosnia. I also covered other wars, so, you know, I may be talking too much about Bosnia, but I think it is relevant. In Bosnia, there was exceptionally good coverage, I think, and I'm biased on this, but I think from the journalists who were on the ground, largely foreign journalists, but also a lot of Bosnian journalists, really good coverage of actually what was going on. But then in the foreign capitals, in Washington, D.C., but also London and France, France and Britain were very important elements of the international community at the time. The reporting was terrible because it reflected the kind of briefings that the journalists were getting from all their government sources and all the think tank people. And they were just saying, oh, it's a mess.
We have 15 seconds, Peter.
So we have the same problem now where there's a lot of bad coverage coming out of the capitals, such as Washington, although from the ground itself, reporting's quite excellent.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Peter Maas, journalist, former senior editor for The Intercept, author of Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War. We'll link to your latest piece in The Washington Post. He also covered U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq for The New York Times. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for Bitcoover FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.